From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Wisconsin no longer has any statewide coronavirus restrictions in place. That's after a closely divided Wisconsin Supreme Court struck down the governor's stay-at-home order yesterday, siding with the Republican-controlled legislature against Democratic Governor Tony Evers. Evers told MSNBC that it's now, quote, the Wild West in his state.
At this point in time, there is no orders. There's nothing that's compelling people to do anything other than having chaos here.
We'll have more on Wisconsin in a moment, but first, in Michigan, people with weapons gathered outside of the state capitol in the rain to protest the state's stay-at-home orders. And for more, we're joined by M.L. Elric, investigative reporter with the Detroit Free Press. And M.L., the state legislature actually canceled Thursday's session because of the protests. They ended early and said they won't meet again until next week. This actually feels like a big deal.
Well, there was quite a bit of controversy the last time this protest group came to Lansing, where armed men and perhaps some armed women went inside the state house and were just outside the legislative chambers shouting at lawmakers. And in Michigan, we are an open carry state. So people felt intimidated. Lawmakers, some said they got bulletproof vests on. And the last time there was a recent session, one of the lawmakers came to work with her own armed escort. Since then, the Capitol Commission, which is sort of a non-public body or non-elected officials that oversee the grounds of the Capitol, said they were going to reconsider whether or not weapons could be brought into the state house. Even some Republican lawmakers who are very pro-Second Amendment have been making some sounds like this is a policy we might want to reconsider.
I see. Yeah. What did these protesters tell you?
They're very upset that the governor has basically continued to keep small businesses and some larger ones closed. Some people were upset that a barber in Owosso who had defied the order, and a septuagenarian barber, had his license revoked, so they thought that was tyrannical. Others think that other states have plans to reopen the state and that Michigan does not, so they're upset about that. In fact, Michigan does have a plan. It's a 6-stage plan, but that doesn't satisfy the folks who are out protesting. And a lot of people just came out, I think, because they wanted to see like-minded people or because they wanted to get something off their chest. We saw anti-abortion protesters. We saw anti-vaxxers out there. And there were, of course, a lot of supporters of President Trump and some people who just think anything the government does is rigged, and they're willing to stand out in the rain to tell us about it.
ML, can you take a step back for us to look at Michigan? We know that the state has this 6-phase plan for reopening. A lot of that, of course, is contingent on being able to assess the spread of this disease. About 50,000 confirmed cases in Michigan. Tell us what's happening in Detroit and the state of testing there.
The city has been at the forefront of testing. The state still says they need more test kits, but in the city of Detroit, where the mayor has been pretty resourceful in getting test kits and using these Abbott quick testing machines, more than 10,000 cases of COVID-19 have been identified, and we've had over 1,200 deaths. The city has tested somewhere between 25 and 30,000 people, but the mayor says he believes that 1 in 12 Detroiters have the virus, whether they know it or not. And by far, the greatest category that's been decimated by this in Detroit's population is nursing home residents, where the infection rate was somewhere around 25%.
You mentioned those testing efforts. So Detroit had this massive drive-through testing effort at the fairgrounds. And the Abbott test, it's a 15-minute test. We're just learning that the FDA is now investigating the accuracy of those tests. It's a real concern that they might be falsely reassuring people that they don't have the virus. Has the city spoken or responded at all to the FDA's investigation on the accuracy of these tests?
So we still need to ask the mayor about the FDA weighing in on this, but previous reports that have questioned the accuracy of the Abbott tests, he has said that he has full confidence in them. Detroit was the first city to get some of these machines and start doing testing. They have been a key part to returning the city workforce. because of some of the concerns about the accuracy, the city performed its own, not exactly a double-blind test, but they basically took 50 people and tested them with the Abbott machine and then with a swab that they sent to the state laboratories. And they say that in almost every case, the results are identical. So whatever other people are finding about these, the mayor of Detroit has staked the safety of city workers and a lot of other people on their accuracy. And he seems to be entirely confident in their results. And what he has said is that the problem in these other cases is that the test samples were not treated as they're supposed to be. They were not preserved or tested quickly enough. And in Detroit, they say we're following the rules and that we're getting accurate results.
That's M.L. Elric, investigative reporter with the Detroit Free Press and host of Soul of Detroit podcast. Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure.
Well, now to Wisconsin, where photos of bars reopening have been making the rounds on social media. Let's bring in Femi Oke, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English, for our social media roundup. Hi, Femi.
Hello there, Jeremy.
Well, and for those who haven't seen some of the images of the bars open in Wisconsin, they could be quite shocking during the pandemic. They appear to show dozens of people crammed shoulder to shoulder with no face masks. What are you seeing?
Oh, one of the most infamous posts came from Nick's Bar. And at the moment, almost 10,000 likes from Nick's Bar. You see a picture of customers. They're very cozy, sitting together. You cannot see a mask. And the tweet from Nick's Bar says, 45 minutes after the bars open in Wisconsin, people went crazy when they saw that. For instance, in a minivan hell, those who will unfairly suffer, the people who continue to stay at home and end up getting exposed at the grocery store when trying to get some needed food, or because they happen to walk down an aisle by drunk Deborah, who just had to run to the bar immediately when opened. So I looked at Governor Evers' Twitter feed to see what he was saying, even though the stay-at-home executive order has been overturned. And he's still advising people in his state, stay at home, stay safe. So Sammy Joe tweeted on Thursday, "Nope, I had a wonderful sit-down breakfast in a local restaurant this morning, and I will continue to act as free as my constitutional rights provide me." So that's just a little a viewpoint of what social is picking up from Wisconsin and the bars being able to open and serve customers again.
Another hashtag that is getting a lot of attention this week is hashtag Obamagate. President Trump has tweeted about it, but has not said what it is exactly. It was actually trending last weekend. What is behind it?
Oh, it was such a huge trend last weekend. I thought it was an event that was happening, hashtag Obamagate. There were around about 2 million tweets. And I'm thinking, what am I missing out on? What's going on here? So what Obamagate is, it's basically rebranded from Spygate. So it's the idea that the FBI were allegedly spying on the Trump campaign. That was back in 2016. And that when Trump won, they tried to discredit Trump by connecting his win to Russian interference. So that is, in a nutshell, Obamagate. And it's been rebranded, formerly known as Spygate.
And Twitter itself has been accused of trying to downplay interest in Obamagate. What else are people saying about it on social media?
Let me give you a little snippet from Ben Look. Ben tweeted, "Twitter is trying to push down Obamagate to number 7 trending, and I've seen 1.19 million tweets." And he's absolutely right. The number of tweets for Obamagate were really high. So I looked into how Twitter determines how trends are made and how they number them. And they use an algorithm, and it's tailored to who you follow, your interests, the topics, maybe what else is trending on your feed. So it's the algorithm, rather than maybe Jack Dorsey as the CEO of Twitter, that may well impact how high up your hashtag that you're following or you're tweeting with goes in terms of Twitter trending. So it may be an algorithm that's biased, and that's a whole different conversation, but it wasn't Jack Dorsey trying to stop Obamagate from trending at number one.
Okay. Well, on a lighter note, Femi, many people on social have been taking up challenges, and one of the cutest ones you've seen is the fruit snack challenge, where parents put a snack in front of their little kids, ask them to wait, and film what happens next. Let's listen to one that you shared of a toddler patiently waiting to eat a bowl of fruit snacks.
Can I eat it now?
No, you can't eat it now. Wait, 1 second. I'll be right back, okay? Okay. Don't touch it, okay?
Okay. Okay. Oh. What are some of the cutest ones you're seeing, Femi?
I love this one from Shefra Musamos. And I'll post all of these and I'll connect them with @HereAndNow so you can watch them later on Twitter. So the little lad found the secret camera that was filming him to see if he could resist the tasty snacks. And he completely forgot about the snacks and did a dance routine in front of the secret camera instead. And then to really see the agony, one little miss was posted on Who Cutcha Twitter feed. And she can see the Fruit Loops. She touches them. She twirls the plate. Her face is in agony. And she just about makes it. This is very cruel. It's very funny. And I get the feeling that this is what happens when parents are left at home at kids under lockdown. But it really is a sweet and wholesome challenge. Mm-hmm. So look out for it. Hashtag Fruit Snack Challenge. I'll post some of my favorites online.
Femi Oke, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Femi, thank you. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too, Jeremy. Take care.
The coronavirus may never go away. That's from Dr. Mike Ryan, director of the World Health Organization's Emergencies Program. Dr. Ryan says the world has to manage and come to terms with the virus like it has with HIV. But there is no guarantee it will ever be completely eradicated. For more, we're joined by Lawrence Gostin, professor of law at Georgetown University and director of the O'Neill Institute for National and Global Health Law. And professor, explain what Dr. Ryan was talking about. Why wouldn't a successful vaccine mean the end of COVID-19?
Well, you know, the truth is that we've actually only eradicated one disease in all of human history, which is smallpox, one major disease. We've eliminated, which is a different term, it's a regional term where you reduce the number. We've eliminated certain diseases like childhood diseases, like measles, chickenpox, mumps, which were common at one time, but they're less common now, but you still have outbreaks. We are going to probably have to live with this virus for the long term, even if we do get a vaccine.
What about the notion of herd immunity, that once a certain percentage of the population has been exposed to this disease and presumably developed antibodies against it, you've effectively stopped the virus from being able to spread? Is there a way to safely get to that point?
We'll probably hit periods where we can do that. But think about this. There are always going to be new people being born and coming in without immunity. Immunity is likely not to be forever. It'll probably be waning, as it is with other coronaviruses. And so over time, you'll lose your immunity. And importantly, the vaccine probably is not going to be 100% effective. Remember, you know, the current influenza vaccine, even when we have a good match, is only about 40-50% effective.
You know, all of us really have never experienced anything like this in our lifetime. So I think although we understand the history of other diseases, it's hard to wrap our heads around this idea. The only thing we can get close to is, like you said, influenza and understanding how we respond to the flu every year. So does controlling this disease's spread in the future then start to look like responding to the flu? Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I can. And, you know, you're so right, Tanya, that, you know, coronavirus may or may not be seasonal like the flu. The good news is that coronaviruses don't seem to be as genetically adaptable as flu viruses. Flu viruses are, you know, they're constantly swapping genes, adapting. And so every year, the vaccine kind of has to make an educated guess about what the circulating strain is going to be. We may be in a better position with coronavirus if we had, you know, thinking about the most hopeful scenario. So we may be seeing something anywhere from, you know, measles through to influenza through to even something worse. We've never conquered HIV/AIDS, and of course, we don't have a vaccine for that at all.
We're learning about two people who took a serology test in Washington State, and it showed their blood positive for antibodies to COVID-19, maybe as early as late December, which really throws off the original timeline of when a health officials first said the virus might have been here in the United States. What does that tell us, and why does this information matter?
You know, it matters a lot, and frankly, it doesn't surprise me at all. I suspect that although it wasn't until December 30th that China reported the first case of coronavirus to the World Health Organization, many of us think that it had been circulating for a month, maybe 2 months, or even more. And so it doesn't surprise me, but what it means is that we most likely have been having, you know, reasonably widespread silent community transmission in the United States for far longer than we imagined, which is why it's so very difficult to get a handle on this epidemic now in the United States and why we've become the epicenter.
Oh, so, I mean, really, this brings up, though, when you talk about our behaviors and how we respond to it. We were talking this week about quarantine fatigue. I think we're at a point where many people are getting frustrated with the state of things, and also lockdowns, opening up cities, when we're going to do these things. What would you say to people who hear something like this and say, well, if we have to live with this virus forever, why should I even bother with social distancing now?
You know, because it's really our only hope until we get a vaccine. We are going to be in a better position when we get a vaccine and we get an effective treatment. You know, think of it like this. You're in a battle and the enemy is really strong and you don't have any weapons. And that's where we are now. So the only thing we have is classic public health measures, social distancing, personal hygiene, testing, screening, contact tracing, isolation and quarantine. Those things, they can work. You know, they've worked for so many diseases in the past, and we know they work with coronavirus because we've seen it happen in places like Israel, South Korea, and other countries, and Germany, even closer to home. So we can do this. You know, the public just needs to stick it out. But I'm really worried. I'm writing a major medical journal article now about, you know, the so-called, we've talked about this dark fall and winter, because we're going to have circulating influenza virus, circulating coronavirus with probably a major second and third wave. And so we do absolutely have to be vigilant. Whatever the politicians are telling you, the public health and scientific community are pretty consistent and pretty clear, which is that we have to stay the course.
That's Lawrence Gostin, professor of law at Georgetown University and director of the O'Neill Institute for National and Global Health Law. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me, Tanya.
Now, by now, many of you have already received that federal relief payment either directly in your bank accounts or as a check in the mail. Most eligible individuals should get $1,200 from the Internal Revenue Service, but hundreds of thousands of households across the country could miss out on this money, not because they earn too much, but because of the way they filed their taxes. From member station WBUR, Shannon Dooling explains.
Henry always dreamt of becoming a U.S. citizen, to officially belong to what he calls the land of the free. And not long ago, he did.
I was happy to become a naturalized U.S. citizen on February 12th. But then I was surprised. The first impression I get of the government is that I'm being discriminated against.
Discriminated against, he says, for being one of the millions of immigrants living in what's known as a mixed immigration status household. Henry is originally from Kenya. He lives in Taunton, Massachusetts, with his three children, who are also U.S. citizens. His wife still lives in Kenya. We agreed to use only Henry's first name because he worries speaking with us could jeopardize his wife's green card application. In fact, it's that green card application which led Henry and his wife to file taxes jointly, he with a Social Security number and his wife with an Individual Tax Identification Number, or ITIN.
When we file together, it strengthens our case in the immigration process because it shows that we are husband and wife, legally married, and that we do our financial things, including paying taxes, together.
But when it comes to getting a stimulus check, Henry, his wife, and hundreds of thousands of other families in similar positions could find they're penalized for following these tax rules.
if one member of the family has a social security number and the other one has an ITIN and they file jointly, it's an unfortunate situation. They won't benefit.
Ava Malona heads up the Massachusetts Immigrant and Refugee Advocacy Coalition. She estimates hundreds of thousands of households in the U.S. file taxes with an individual tax ID, most frequently used by undocumented workers. Had Henry filed taxes individually, using only his Social Security number, he'd be looking at close to $3,000 in stimulus funds for himself and his three children. But because he and his wife filed jointly, under the current legislation, he's not eligible for any of that.
And it's really, really in this very difficult time, making it impossible for them to survive. There are thousands of families in Massachusetts who are in desperate need.
Massachusetts and California have established emergency funds for people who aren't eligible for unemployment benefits and who, in cases like Henry's, miss out on the federal stimulus funds as well. Meanwhile, a class action suit filed on behalf of U.S. citizen children of undocumented immigrants challenges the CARES Act, claiming denying stimulus payments to millions of young people amounts to treating them like second-class citizens. We reached out to the Republican senator from Kentucky, Mitch McConnell, who was instrumental in drafting the stimulus legislation that includes these tax stipulations. His office never responded. The IRS confirms a taxpayer and everyone listed on their return must have a Social Security number in order to be eligible for stimulus payments.
So in my specific case, I am a U.S. citizen. I filed my taxes. I do not get any of the stimulus checks that were issued. I get zero.
Henry says he would have used that money to buy food and help pay his mortgage. He hopes Congress will amend the next stimulus package so households like his can benefit. For Here and Now, I'm Shannon Dooling.
New retail numbers are out today from the Census Bureau, and the situation facing stores, bars, and restaurants is worse than what economists thought. Total retail sales dropped more than 16% in April. That's almost double the drop in March, making it the worst two-month drop on record. For more, let's bring in Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. And Mike, not even at the height of the Great Recession did retail sales drop even 5%. We're now more than three times that. How concerning are these figures today?
Well, you know, they're obviously concerning. And as you pointed out, they were a little bit worse than what the sort of consensus of economists was. But clearly, it's not that surprising given the shutdown to so many parts of the economy. And there's kind of a general sense that this is as bad as it will get. Because even this month, parts of the economy are reopening, and that should hopefully continue in June. But obviously, there's a real concern about, even though if we do rebound from these awful numbers this month, how quickly it'll take before we're back to normal with sales actually increasing compared to the year earlier period. And that's a big open question for economists that they just simply can't answer at the moment.
Well, and when you dive into these numbers and you look at the industries, spending on clothing accessories was down almost 90% compared to last April. For restaurants and bars, spending was down about 49%. How much of this drop is because brick and mortar locations are closed? And how much is it because consumers are pulling back and trying to save more?
So both issues are definitely at play, and it's tough to sort of suss out and quantify exactly which one is the bigger issue for numbers like this. I will say, though, our economists at Bloomberg did interpret this report as a sign that consumers did get very thrifty last month, obviously either because they lost their job or their own businesses are struggling, or simply because they're worried about the future. And that may explain why they were a little bit worse than even economists expected. People are certainly in savings mode now rather than spending mode.
Well, we've already heard that some major retailers, J. Crew and Neiman Marcus, have filed for bankruptcy. Now everybody's waiting on JCPenney, which could be the next one to do so. And I guess there's a question of whether these stores might ever be able to reopen.
Yeah, you know, it's important to point out that just declaring bankruptcy doesn't necessarily mean that a retailer like this will end up closing their stores. It's just a legal process that they go through when their debt load is so great that they can't keep up with their interest payments on it. So JCPenney, for example, will likely try to restructure its debt. So the investors who loaned it money will take some losses, but the chain would hopefully survive the process and the stores remain open. The other option, obviously, is liquidation, where you basically sell off the company's assets to repay investors something, from that process. So we'll have to see how each of these bankruptcy proceedings proceeds to see which happens to what company. I will say there was one alarming stat out from the website Open Table. They're predicting that 1 in 4 restaurants in the country will simply go out of business because of this. So pretty scary thought.
Yeah. And by the way, on the bright side, there are some places that are doing well. Apparently GameStop, which sells video games, saw sales explode more than 1,000% in April. And Lululemon, known for its leggings, saw sales go up 200%. So people are buying some things. Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Most of us have been cooking a lot more than usual, which could give us more control over the amount of salt in our food. Americans have long been consuming, on average, more sodium than is recommended. Joining us now is Dr. Dariush Mozafarian, who's a cardiologist, professor of medicine at Tufts, and the dean of the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition Science and Policy. Doctor, welcome.
Thank you so much, Jeremy.
All right, well, let's start with what people should do. What is the right amount of sodium that we should be consuming every day?
You know, this has been an area that 20 years ago, everyone thought was quite settled. And then some research started coming out, made this a little bit more controversial the last 5 or 10 years. And so Congress asked the National Academies of Medicine to review all of the evidence. And they did over a couple of years. And just last year came out with their recommendations, which were very clear that for optimal health, to especially reduce risk of heart attacks and stroke, all adults should be eating less than about 2,300 milligrams per day of sodium.
But we're probably all eating more than that.
Yeah, there's actually very few Americans that are at that level of about 2,300 milligrams. The average intake in the U.S. is probably more around 3,500 milligrams. And globally, we're kind of right about average. There are some countries that are actually around 2,300 milligrams a day on average, where they should be. Mostly countries in Africa, but there are also countries that are much, much higher than we are. We're around 3,500. There's countries that are around 5,500, especially in Asia and China, where there's, you know, huge amounts of soy sauce.
Now, why is it that we're consuming so much salt in this country? I know that now that we have some of this nutritional information available, especially when you go out to eat, you can see that, you know, a burrito bowl at Chipotle is going to go way above probably even what you should have in an entire day, let alone one meal. But there are a lot of foods that we consume that you wouldn't even think have so much salt, but do.
You know, that's really one of the most surprising things, I think, to most people, is that the foods that we think of as salty don't actually have a lot of salt. Things like salted nuts or potato chips, you know, sure, they have some salt. But really what salt is used for in the U.S. food supply, it's for preservation. And so bread, there's enormous amounts of salt in most breads. For canned foods and some frozen foods, there's, you know, enormous amounts of salt. Restaurant foods, and also, if you actually take a food that's in a package and then you microwave it or heat it up weeks after it was cooked, it normally would have a very artificial and kind of harsh taste. And so salt hides that, you know, flavor. Mm-hmm. And so as just one example, you know, a serving of potato chips might have 80 or 100 milligrams of sodium on average. A single slice of bread, just one slice, kind of 300 milligrams of sodium. You know, wow. Bread shouldn't last for weeks in the grocery store and on your shelf without going bad, but it does. You know, much of that is the high sodium.
So what are the health effects of eating too much sodium?
Well, the most clearly established is effects on blood pressure. Sodium gets into our bloodstream and it expands the volume, the amount of fluid in your bloodstream, and it makes the kidneys work harder to pump it out, and it makes the heart work harder to pump that extra fluid. And so it raises blood pressure. And that increased blood pressure increases risk of stroke in the brain and heart attacks. And long-term, over many years, it's pretty clear from animal experiments and also some human studies that that long-term effect also causes scarring of the blood vessels, scarring of the heart, scarring of the kidneys, which leads to kidney failure and, you know, other problems like heart failure, even above and beyond the effect on the blood pressure.
Are there positives of having a lot of salt in your diet?
There really aren't any clear beneficial effects of having too much sodium. There are very traditional populations, indigenous populations living in jungles and other places who have 600, 700, 800 milligrams of sodium per day, you know, much, much less than the United States. And they are very healthy and live a long time. Obviously, they have lots of other ways their lives are different, so we can't say that they're healthy just because of that. But there's no noticeable adverse, you know, effects of eating very low amounts. But what's, you know, incredible is the human tongue has different taste receptors. The taste receptor for salt is very adaptable. And so within a few weeks, if you changed your, you know, salt intake and you increased it or decreased it dramatically, the tongue receptors adjust so the food tastes the same again. And so, you know, what I say is in these countries where people are on average consuming, you know, 2,300, 2,400 milligrams, much, much less than the United States, kids aren't telling their parents, hey, my food doesn't taste salty enough. And in these countries where people are consuming 5,000, 5,500 milligrams, way more than the United States, nobody's complaining about salty food. You get used to it very quickly. And so that means if as a population, as a whole, we slowly reduce salt in this country over a few years, nobody would notice. All of our tongues would adapt and we'd be healthier.
That is what the individual can do. What about restaurants and the makers of packaged foods? Is there something that they ought to be doing on a grander scale to bring down the amount of salt that's used to preserve things?
Well, it has to be system-wide. If just one set of restaurants or just one set of companies does it by themselves, then, you know, Americans are used to a certain level of salt in their foods, and they'll think those foods don't have enough flavor, and those products will lose sales, they'll go out of business, and it won't work. And so the solution has to be everybody doing it together. Other countries, like, for example, Britain and Turkey, have done this. The government has gone and partnered with industry, and they've together come up with voluntary sodium targets where everybody together says, look, we're going to get to this goal by 10 years, and it levels the playing field. In the United States in 2016, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration proposed this and came out with 2-year and 10-year voluntary sodium targets. And much of the industry actually embraced this and said, yeah, we're happy with this. Let's do this together. But some parts of the industry didn't, and they pressured Congress, and Congress blocked the FDA from partnering with industry for even these voluntary targets. I think for listeners, you should be telling your elected officials in the federal government that it's time for the FDA to reinitiate this discussion.
And would it have, do you think, the same kind of impact on public health that reducing the amount of sugar that we're taking in would have?
Well, you know, sugar and salt are the two major harmful additives. And of course, reducing those alone won't give us a purely healthy diet. We also need to increase the good. You know, we need to eat more fruits and vegetables and nuts and fish and beans and other healthy foods. From our research and from research of others, there's actually more harm from too much salt than from too much sugar. So if you wanted to get bang for your buck, you know, salt is an excellent place to start. And as I mentioned, you know, reducing salts can be done without really changing taste. It's really more about changing how we preserve and package our foods long term. And New York actually has created a national sugar and salt reduction initiative, and they're trying to work with state governments and other big cities and some companies to try to get there. But this really has to be done, you know, with the help of the federal government.
Dr. Mozafarian, do you think that while so much of the country is working from home, staying at home, this might actually be a good opportunity for people to try out a diet that they can control a little bit more with less salt?
Well, you know, there's so much going on with COVID-19, and I think that nutrition is as important as ever. I mean, we've known in medicine for years that if, you know, you're generally malnourished, you're less able to resist infection. And so people need to keep up their nutrition as well as their sleep and exercise. And that's hard. But also, you know, with schools closing and with people losing their jobs, especially hourly workers, you know, people don't have enough money anymore to buy food. So food is a huge priority. I think for those that are able to do it, restaurants being closed, this is a great time to learn how to cook and get reacquainted with cooking. That's the simplest way to lower salt. About 80% of salt in the U.S. food supply is from packaged and processed foods. And so if you just cook at home, you're going to cut out a lot of salt. But we also need to remember that, you know, there's many millions of Americans, who kids and families, that are not going to have enough food during this crisis. And so there, salt is not the concern. It's just getting them enough food. So, you know, food is just so central to health. We can't forget it while we're focusing on this incredible crisis of coronavirus.
That is Dr. Dariush Mozafarian, who is a cardiologist and professor of medicine at Tufts University and the dean of the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition, Science, and Policy. Dr. Mozafarian, thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
And by the way, I mentioned a Chipotle burrito bowl. It can be 2,600 milligrams of sodium compared to the daily recommended 2,300. But it's not just Chipotle. A turkey bacon guacamole sandwich at Subway is 2,200 milligrams.
The network Showtime debuts today the documentary Basketball County in the Water. It's the latest in a run of sports documentaries to keep fans occupied since most live sports competitions are on hold. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans joins us to discuss upcoming sports documentaries and the era without sports. Hey, Eric.
Hey.
Okay, so I joke that for the last few weeks, my husband has had ESPN on all the time, just in case some miracle happens and sports pops up on the screen somehow.
A hockey game breaks out somewhere.
Exactly. But these documentaries have certainly helped. So let's talk a little bit about this newest one, Basketball County. It's about Prince George's County, Maryland, just outside of D.C. Let's listen.
The county definitely gives you a tough edge, fighting to hold your spot, being able to stay on the court with a bunch of grown men and holding your own. I mean, everybody will say that's everywhere. For us, we live by that.
So that was NBA player Jeff Green, who grew up in PG County. And NBA star Kevin Durant is also from there. He's the executive producer on this film. Does this doc make a compelling case for Prince George's County? I never knew this as a basketball mecca.
I know. Something like 30 NBA players have come from this county, and numerous WNBA players. And what the sense that you get from watching this documentary is there has to be a system that kind of arises to help groom these athletes so that they can excel. Mm. This documentary shows that the first black man to teach physical education in the nation helped establish a basketball program in Prince George's County.
Really?
Yeah. And so he landed on this idea of encouraging young black males to learn basketball and to use the sport as a way to find discipline in their lives, and also use the sport as a way to have new opportunities in society. Hmm. And one of the things they talk about is that if you're a young person from that area and you sort of get involved with playing basketball on the courts in that county, you very quickly find yourself having to compete against people who are much older and more experienced than you, and it forces you to get good really quickly. It's an interesting doc. I think you kind of have to be interested in basketball to really watch it,
Yeah. But
it does sort of explain how a local community can sort of, without really trying, like develop this whole system that produces these amazing players and encourages them and gives them opportunities to become professionals in the sport.
Yeah, interesting. It sounds like something I might want to watch for sure.
Yeah.
Well, ESPN aired the docuseries The Last Dance about Michael Jordan and the Chicago Bulls, but ESPN has more documentaries in this style coming up. What's next?
So ESPN realized that The Last Dance was such a ratings hit and that its audience was sort of starved for stories about sports. So they decided to take three documentaries that they developed for their 30 for 30 documentary series and air them after The Last Dance in the same Sunday time slot. And the first one is Lance, and it's a documentary about, you know, biking champ Lance Armstrong, who, of course, people will remember, was accused of doping, sort of resisted it for years, said people were unfairly accusing him of using performance-enhancing substances, and then Eventually had to admit that he was doing that. So we have a quote where he's talking to the person who's interviewing him for this documentary and trying to talk about, you know, how he's going to talk about his life. Let's just listen to this clip.
I'm not going to lie to you, Marino. I'm not. And I'm not saying that they will. But I'm going to tell you my truth. And my truth is not my version. My truth is the way I remember it.
Yeah. And so part of what's interesting to me about this documentary is that Lance Armstrong seems to either not want to understand or not want to publicly acknowledge is that once you admit a lie that big, you know, how can you possibly expect the public to trust you about anything? And I think the only way he's going to get to the point where people aren't sort of cursing him out in public, because he talks about that in the doc, the only way he's going to get to that point is if he figures out some way to sort of publicly show people that he recognized that those lies hurt a lot of people.
Yeah. Well, I mean, these documentaries, of course, don't make up for our loss of sports at this moment in time, but they do seem to provide like this bit of narrative backstory, kind of 30 for 30 exactly as they are. That's what they are, for people to kind of keep them a little bit entertained, at least folks like me. What do you think?
Yeah. I mean, you know, in talking about 30 for 30, one other thing I wanted to mention is that they have often been criticized for the lack of documentaries that they do about female athletes. And I do think it's important that if the sports media world is going to turn towards documentary until, you know, professional sports start to ramp up again, they're going to have to make an effort to be more equitable in the sports that they're portraying. And they're going to have to make an effort to take a look at female competitors.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's the one thing that kind of bugs me about where we are right now on this, is that we're seeing a bunch of these documentaries come, and too many of them seem centered on males.
Yeah. That's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Eric, as always, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.